Today's collaborator is Shannon Downey of Badass Cross Stitch, who you may know from an amazing photograph taken during the 2017 Women's March. She had a giant embroidery that read, "I'm so angry I stitched this just so I could stab something 3,000 times." At least, that's how I became aware of her. A self-proclaimed craftivist, Shannon combines her passion for fiber art with her passion for dismantling a culture of patriarchy, misogyny, and sexism. Our conversation touches on so many things: creativity, the way questions help us to grow, and the importance of seeing learning as a lifelong endeavor. I was particularly struck by the practice Shannon has of what she calls life editing, learning how to discern what conversations and online engagement are worth her time, attention, and effort, and choosing not to engage around vitriol and hate speech. Content notification, there is some swearing in this episode.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Awesome. Awesome. So thank you for being on the show. And I'm just going to jump right in. The first question that I always ask guests to answer is, it's less of a question, more like just a sharing moment. If you could share a bit about your experience of moving from what I like to describe as I am suffering to there is suffering. So basically, like, what got you started on the path that you're on?
I was raised in a church, which I'm no longer in any way a part of or practice any religion, but it definitely like set a tone for the larger we and community. My parents are like very active in the labor movement. My dad was a union pipe fitter his entire life and was president of the Boston Pipe Fitters Union for years. And so we were involved in I grew up in all sorts of labor movement causes. And, you know, our home very much became the center of some major like political initiatives around the labor movement. So there's sort of always been these themes of the larger we and the larger good in my life. And so it's sort of only natural that my whole life ended up taking that course.
Some people I've spoken to before really share that how like it was really part of their childhood and very formative for them, that their parents were already incredibly involved in some sort of social restorative work. And so they got the exposure, but that there was like the point when they stepped up to the plate, or like it stopped being just like what my family does and actually became something that they were really engaged in. Was there like some experience or a point when you stepped into it, or was it just like organically happened?
Yeah. I mean, it organically happened. There is this like one like really strong moment that was a marker for me, and it's sort of ridiculous for me to recount it now, given who I am and whatever. But I'm going to tell the story anyways. And I don't think I've ever told this story. So
fun.
Here we go. You get the scoop. So in seventh grade, I went to a Catholic school, Roman Catholic school, basically my entire like kindergarten through 12th grade. And in seventh grade, the school was attached to a church. And so we would go to church monthly with our class and for all holidays and myriad of other things. And, religion was a class we took, and it was just all very tied into the church. And so I was very upset that I could not be an altar server. Mm. At that point, it was just altar boys. And for some reason, and really looking back, it had nothing to do with like being an altar server. It had everything to do with the injustice of them telling me I couldn't be one because I was a girl. And so I just sort of became obsessed with the idea that it was ridiculous that I could not be an altar server. Mm-hmm. And that girls couldn't be. And so I would start to bring it up and challenge the priests who would come in to teach us, you know, our religion class. And so I would consistently make them answer me to the question of why can't girls be altar servers? And each week it would be a different priest. So each week it would be a different response. And it started to gain some traction in my classroom. Like, folks were like, yeah, ask that question, Shannon. And then I had an assignment where we had to come up with, like, you know, a survey, and we had to learn how to create a survey and, you know, gather data and then process data. And so I decided that my survey would be sort of an opinion poll of, should girls be allowed to be altar servers? And so I would stand outside Mass and, like, interview people coming out, asking them. And I was, you know, I think I did over 100 interviews, or, you know, my opinion poll. And then I put it into this, in my opinion, absolutely brilliant summary of that the church was totally out of touch and everybody thought it was fine. And there were graphs and it was great. And then we had this one priest come in following that, just to teach religion. I brought it up, and then I told him, you know, like, I did this research and I think you're wrong, and here it is. And I presented it to him, and he was like, well, this is interesting. You know, maybe I'll take this to the Pope when I go there next month. And so I was like, that'd be swell. Can you just, like, I'll type up a special note for the Pope. And,
wow.
And so he did actually take it to the Pope, and sort of came back, and that was John Paul, I think. And he was just sort of like, yeah, so no, but he was really excited about your graphs. And I'm like, cool. And, but I just, like, I wouldn't let it go, and I kept pressing. And what was interesting was when we, like, there was this one time when we had a priest come in, and I asked the question, and he decided to use it as an opportunity to punish us, and specifically to punish me, and to create some real, like, tension in the classroom. And so he decided to not let us go to recess in order to examine that question. And so he made us stay in the classroom. We missed recess, and he just rambled on and on about, you know, how girls were inadequate. And so we were all really angry because we felt so disempowered and just, like, shamed for asking a question. Mm-hmm. But what I learned in that moment about allyship was really interesting, because suddenly the people in the class who had been like, yeah, ask the question, were pissed at me. Mm. And they were just like, you have to stop asking that question because we missed recess and that's not cool. And, like, they were angry. And so I stopped asking the question in class, and I would find other ways to, like, push my agenda, you know, but it was just one of those moments where you're like, okay, oh, I thought you were on my team, but you're only on my team when it's convenient for you. And the minute that you have to suffer as well, or we have to suffer together, you're no longer on board. And I knew in that moment, like, I never want to be that person. That's not allyship. That's not how this works. Coincidentally, and I really believe it was just sheer coincidence, like, 3 years later, girls could be altar servers in my church.
Yeah.
So I felt vindicated, even though I'd passed the point of wanting to be an altar server. I did get to see my little cousin serve, and I was like, cool. Yeah. I'm not going to have anything to do with the church anymore, but I'm super glad that you get to be an altar server.
Yeah, no, that's great. Cause there's a thing in there that, like, for me, it stands out, like, in my Buddhist-y language, as I would call it, is ego. And I always have to be careful about that, because there's, like, the overarching psychologian understanding of ego and, like, healthy ego. But as far as Buddhism's concerned, ego is the idea that we have a fixed solid self, and that self needs to be protected, sort of thing. And so it's interesting, like, you've got your classmates who at first were encouraging until, you know, their fixed sense of self and me and getting what I want gets challenged. And then it's like, oh, that's annoying. But then also that even though you didn't get to be an altar server, something that you did and were passionate about and engaged with, later you could actually see someone else and enjoy it and not have, like, bitterness of, but it's not fair that I didn't get it. You could just be like, cool, I actually got to see that come to fruition for someone else.
Absolutely.
I always think that's a really interesting part in this kind of work when people are really engaged with it. And it's something I think about a lot. And one of the reasons why I love the teachings of Angel Kyodo Williams, because it's like really looking at, like, liberation for all and what does that look like, and getting out of your own way. So it's cool that you experience that getting out of the way and seeing the much bigger picture in that, it, like when you were a kid.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting perspective on it. I like that.
Well, I think like there's a lot of adults who haven't got there yet.
Yeah, well, I think you might be giving me a little too much credit on that one, but I will take it.
Take it. That's another thing I've learned. It's important to take the credit. So there are so many things that I want to talk to you about as an artist and a feminist and queer person. And so I'm going to try and keep it on point by sticking with the theme of the show. Sure. So the general workability of life. So one part of everything being workable is that the approach that we need to take isn't always obvious. We might have a fixed idea of what we want the solution to be or how we think we need to get there. But that's where creativity then is essential. Like if we want to really address injustice and do this work of liberation, then we have to be creative. So what's your experience of the creative process and how it influences your craftivism?
I think that a lot of what I do surprises even me. And there's this sort of, I'm always thinking about how can I do this differently? How can I, like, what can I do next? How can I change it up? So for me, it's always about like, how do I keep surprising people? Because it's in the surprise that I get to connect with them and that I capture them. And so the creative process for me is usually just like, what else can I do? How can I do this different? How can I do something that folks haven't seen before and that's unexpected in order to just get my message read, heard, processed, thought about, connected to, right? Like, I mean, I ran a digital marketing company for 10 years. And so you have to always be thinking about like, what can I do differently? What can I do next? And so sort of applying that to the art that I create and the communities that I'm trying to build around things has been absolutely key to people even being like taking the time to take notice of the different messages that I'm trying to get out into the world and the awareness that I want to raise and the education that I want to provide and really the community that I want to be building.
What's an example of like one of those things that you've come up with and just like this, yeah, this is interesting and different and new and like thrown it out there. What's one of the things that you're like most surprised by yourself that you came up with?
I mean, honestly, like this project that I've just launched, I'm already so surprised by what's happening with it. And I launched it on Saturday. Like, like it's, I didn't expect anything to come of it quite yet. And folks were like clamoring for it and interested in it and wanting to be a part of it before it had even launched. And so to me, that tells me that I'm onto something and that folks are looking for something like this. Like they're looking for something unexpected and unique and different and a different way to connect with each other around really important topics.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that. Can you give like a summary of this project? Badass Herstory.
Probably helpful. So it's called Badass Herstory, and really it's a global craftivism project. So that's craft and activism. Betsy Greer coined that one. Low key though, I mean, this is really like about community building and civic engagement. It's just that I've built a community around fiber art and around embroidery. So that is the mechanism and the tool by which I hope to bring communities together, unexpected communities, communities that haven't formed yet because they're forming around this project, all around the world. And while the project is the catalyst for them coming together and thinking about their personal stories and their personal journeys and then translating that into some piece of fiber art. What I'm hoping is because you can't accomplish one of these pieces in a day or a meeting or a session or whatever, right? Like this is like a multi-step process. So what I'm hoping is that these folks are then going to come back over and over again with the idea of it being sort of a stitching circle, like, you know, used to be. except that once they've figured out what their story is and they're working on the like creative output, then the conversation can shift to, okay, what does our community need? How can we create change in our community? What are we in this room capable of impacting on a micro level or a macro level for that matter? So I hope it's a creative way, and I know it's an unexpected way of getting folks together to think about, you know, systemic change and civic engagement and community building. And I hope it's for folks who maybe wouldn't participate in something like a protest or a rally or right, like like the sort of traditional ways that people can take a stand. This is sort of a new gateway for them.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying about that, like connecting in different ways, I find so important and a big part of discussions that are happening. And I do find it kind of annoying when people are sort of like policing people about staying in bubbles, because I think within your social circle, you can still have really meaning conversations. Yeah. But it sounds like what this is creating a space for people to have conversations outside of those circles, but still with people who are aligned to the same work. So what do you think about the whole conversation side of things and how like working together on a tangible like Stitch project translates for people in their minds of like how to work together on a larger, like let's deconstruct patriarchy project.
Wouldn't that be swell?
I know, right?
like everybody get on that. well, what I'm doing too is because I think that there's, like empowering is one thing and folks being informed is another, but like if you don't have tools and if you aren't taught how to do these things, then I think that a lot of times folks just like don't do it, right? They won't do it because they're not quite sure how, or like, oh, I'm somebody who's, you know, I'm interested in all of these things, but I've definitely never like facilitate a conversation around racial equity in my community, right? Like that's huge. And that can be very scary, especially if you've never done it before. And so what I've been building is all of these resources, and I'm finishing up this toolkit, and it's, you know, I don't know, a 30-page document around like, here's what this could look like. Here are different ways that you could facilitate conversations. Here are ways to find experts to come in and like join your Stitch circle and facilitate a conversation. Here's how you can create your action path as a group. And what do you want to accomplish? And how do you set your goals and understand intention? And then, you know, what resources do you have available to you as in the community? And should you be partnering with an organization? And what does that look like? And so I'm this toolkit, and the idea of this is really around just trying to like help folks who are like into it, they're enthused by it, they're ready to bring community together, but maybe they're just a little overwhelmed with moving it from this project, which is like you can go to my website, get informed, and then speak confidently about this project. And then I help them take the next step to turn the space into a safe space to have hard conversations, and also to determine, like, do we see anything in our community that we can unite around in order to create positive change? And if so, how do we do that? And what does that look like?
It's great. That's actually a question that I did want to ask, because, like, I'm a self-starter. I like to tell people that I'm allergic to procrastination. Mm. And then people always ask me, like, oh, can you bottle that? Give it to me. And so I am always working on like, how do I share with people how I motivate myself, how I keep going, how I like build on tools that are already there so that when I want to, I can just engage. So like, what are the supports that you have around that? Like, obviously you're sharing them in your toolkit, which will be available, but.
Yeah, for free, for download on my website. Yeah, I feel like I have had a lifetime of that, and I consistently I surround myself with people who are much smarter than me and, you know, more informed and more articulate. And I ask them a million questions and I absorb what I can. And I read a lot and I work to understand and to look for the how those things can be repackaged, those ideas, those ways of communicating, those tools can be repackaged in a more accessible way. Because I feel like once you have some like really in-depth knowledge of something that's really complicated, it becomes very hard for a lot of people to sort of distill that down, circle back, and get to a place, like meet somebody where they're at in a way that then can move them. And so that's sort of what I'm obsessed with, is like, how do I take these things that are really challenging and really hard and really complicated and that we've been living in? And so we don't necessarily even see them as problematic, and just start to call those things out and bring it to a place where anybody can accept that knowledge and can get into the sort of growth ladder, if you will, for that particular topic. And so that's what I think I'm pretty good at it. I think that I got, you know, there's a lot more work to be done, but that's what I keep doing, is like, I fill myself with as much knowledge as I can. And I'm all about never reinventing a wheel. Like, that's such a waste of time to me. Mm-hmm. So I will borrow and adapt and whatever is out there and whatever I can. And I always find it interesting when there's sort of like unexpected ways that those things come about. Like when I'm trying to help people think through, for example, for herstory, like, what is your story? Mm-hmm. And how do you get that onto a 12 by 12 piece of fabric? Like, for me, that's so exciting and super easy, right? But I realize that is not like that will stop some people from participating because it's too overwhelming. And so then it was a matter of like, okay, what are the different tools that I can put in front of them to help them start thinking through that and start culling their stories? And so, I mean, there's everything from like when I taught middle school, like, oh, here's a story plot. And so let's fill in the blanks of the story plot of your story. Like, what are the critical incidents? Where's the climax? Like, who are the characters and what's the plot? And so for me, it's just finding like really weird and interesting ways to like help people connect to those sort of complicated and in-depth topics.
Yeah, I really appreciate your enthusiasm for questioning. And I think like there's also there, like you have this attitude that learning never ends.
Oh, never. I don't learn like 10 new things a day. It was a wasted day.
That's fantastic. How do you deal with that when you come up against that with people? Because like I've come up against that with people where they'll say things like, just like I remember someone saying to me bluntly, like, oh, I would love to learn. I can't remember what it was. It was something to do with design, because that's one of the mm-hmm. things, many things in my back pocket. Sure. Like, I'd love to do the design, but I'm too old to go back to school now. And I was like, wow, that's like such a limited view.
That's usually how I respond. Absolutely not. We're talking about this. But I think sometimes I just call that shit out. Oh, sorry. I don't know if I can curse on
this
podcast. That's fine. It's impossible for me not to.
It gets a content notification warning and we're done.
Oh, great. Okay, great. I'm going to curse up a storm. No. I make it a point to call that shit out, because I think that in a lot of cases, like I've seen that particular scenario play out 100 times, right? Where it's like, I'm too old to learn that. And people, and so then I've observed, like, how do other people respond to that? Because I'm never alone when that happens. And sometimes people just laugh, right? They're just like, oh, ha, ha, ha. Nobody challenges that. I'm just like, we have to talk about what you just said.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? And I'm like, why do you believe that? Do you actually believe that? Or like, are you just saying that because you, you know, like, are you lazy? You don't strike me as a lazy person, right? Like, what is this ageist thing that you, like, limitation you just put on yourself. Is it, do you need to know where you can go learn that thing? And for me, that's when, then I'm always like, let me tell you about, and then I've always got 10 things in my pocket around, like, I just have a resource for everything. So I'm like, you know, you could learn that on Lydia.com in like days, and here's how, and you know, you could do this. You don't even, like, you don't have to go to school for that. But a lot of times when I start asking people and questioning them, it's because they have other limiting beliefs in there as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just like, I'm too old for that. It's like, I'm afraid I would fail at that. It's I don't know where I would learn that, because their view might be that I have to go back and get another degree, right?
Yeah.
Not aware of the resources around them. It's right. Like there's I don't have time for that. Well, that's a very different response than I'm too old for that. And mm-hmm. So why are you putting your age on it? Let's talk about what are the actual barriers to that, and can they be worked around? Because if you want to learn something, you should learn it. And so for me, it's like calling it out and then getting them super excited about it and the possibility that is within them to do this thing, and then giving them a whole bunch of tools for different ways that they could learn it, and then be like, now you have to go do it.
For now, some reason, if you don't, it's because you really don't. You don't want to.
For real. But for some reason, it's like people just need permission. And they need a cheerleader. They need somebody to say, you can do this. And like, how easy is that for other humans to just do that for each other?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And also, just little point, that in itself is challenging the overarching culture and the idea of like hyper individualism, that we are like self-made somehow.
Yeah. which is such a ridiculous fucking statement to me. The idea that anybody believes that they have accomplished anything on their own is asinine to me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, what? No, look back at your life. There's not one thing you've accomplished on your own. You would be dead if you had to like function on your own. You can't do it. And so why wouldn't we spend as much time as possible helping each other to succeed in the ways that they want to succeed?
That's beautiful. So there are so many inequalities in the world. Overwhelm happens and burnout happens.
Sure.
So what are the tools that you have that help you maintain your courage and commitment and like, so you keep showing up?
I'm really good at editing my life. I think social media and the internet have a very particular and insidious way of affecting people and getting people, like getting us to a burnout faster mm-hmm. than maybe we ever have before, because it's so easy for people to be so cruel and mean and negative on social media, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've taken my sort of like editing practices and applied them to social media as well. And that, I think that as I've started to like teach other or, you know, help other people figure out how to get burnt out less or, you know, slower, if you will, mm-hmm. right? The idea is you have to deconstruct and create boundaries around this new life that we live, around this idea of that you're connected 24/7 and you need to be available to mm-hmm. people 24/7 and that you need to respond to people. I am like, I feel so sad when I see folks who are just like, well, I have to respond to this troll right now, or this person said something hurtful, so I need to respond to them. You know, you don't even owe them a response. You can just not. You can delete that. You can block them.
Yeah.
Right? But we have created these rules that don't exist around how we're supposed to, I'm using air quotes, but you can't see it, so I'm air quoting, how we're supposed to communicate in these new ways via these new tools that aren't really new anymore. But so for me, it's editing. It's like monitoring what I take in, monitoring what I watch. You know, I'm on social media a lot mm-hmm. and I feel very positive about it. And I feel very positive about it because I have curated my communities online the same way that I can curate them in real life. You know, like my friends are my friends for very specific reasons, because they are beautiful humans who want to make my life better, and I want to make their lives better. And so that's how I apply it to my digital communities as well. So yeah, I'll block the heck out of somebody. I'll delete them, whatever. To be clear, not somebody who disagrees with me, but it's the vitriol that folks need to be able to say no to and just like put a stop to for their own, you know, spiritual health and mental health. So I do a lot of that, and I spend a lot of time outside, like in nature, kayaking and biking and hiking and just doing things that remind me and really like keep perspective.
Mm-hmm. There's like two things in what you said that came to mind for me. One was the just deleting comments. Something that my wife said to me several months ago that made me laugh, and I was like, that's great, I'm going to use that, was you can delete things that people write on your Facebook wall that you don't like. It's your Facebook wall. It's not protected by the American Constitution.
Yeah, totally. Like it blows my mind that we're starting to create this culture of like entitlement around who gets to say what, where, and how when we're talking about things like my Instagram account. I'm like, this is my queendom. I decide what happens here. And honestly, I take that role really seriously as somebody who's cultivated a sizable community on Instagram, for example. I believe it is my job to protect those folks mm-hmm. from what happens on my page or through my posts. If I get the trolls on there and they start trolling after my community and getting them fired up and creating unpleasant community vibe, like those people they get gone. Mm-hmm. I will delete them, and I will delete their comments, and I'll message the person and let them know, like, I just want you to know this is what I did, because no one should speak to you like that.
Yeah. And so that then is the other thing that I was thinking about, like the way you were talking about it is like it's as much about not letting that person continue their path of vitriol as it is creating a safe space where people feel comfortable. And it's like that whole reducing harm or not causing harm. And I think like this is where it gets sidetracked when people are like, oh, well, you're just creating a bubble. And it's like, mm-hmm. no, because there is nothing useful and nothing to be gained about letting people be mean.
Right. Absolutely not. That's just, I mean, it's there, nothing good will come of that. And I will not create space for that. That's different from differing opinions and differing viewpoints and those being presented and sometimes unskillfully presented, which I can recognize the difference between somebody who is presenting something unskillfully or doesn't have as much nuance in their typing skills, you know, like in their typing communication versus I'm going to murder you, which, you know, happens every day. So like that kind of shit, nope, you're gone.
And that then also speaks a bit to, you were talking about intention a little bit earlier and mm-hmm. intentionality. How do you work with intentionality in your life? What does that look like for you?
Everything I do starts with why. And you can ask my staff, they find it so obnoxious, but anytime they have any idea, I'm like, okay, why? And so now it's to the point where they're just like, here's the why. And then they give me the pitch, right? Awesome. And I'm like, that's great. Thank you. Now I understand the intention behind it and the value behind it. And so let's talk about the idea itself. But that for me is, I probably ask myself 700 times a day, why am I doing this? What is the intention behind this? And that works on a very micro level, and it works on a massive macro level for me in just like major choices that I make and relationships that I'm keeping or not keeping and how I want to respond to somebody versus, you know, maybe how I do respond to them, and then taking a step back to say like, here's how I wanted to do that and I did not do that. And the next time I'm going to do it this way because that's how I want to come to this conversation or... Yeah. So it's, I mean, I'm obsessed with intention. I need to understand why I'm doing anything. But that, I mean, that's been sort of a very learned process throughout my life. And I feel like only in the last, 5 years have I gotten really good at it And I've seen the trajectory of my life change when I can be honest with myself, mm-hmm. right? Like I was no longer happy running my digital marketing company. And it took me 2 years to come to the place to understand that it was at that point, right, towards the end there, it was only ego that was keeping me in it, right? It was only that my identity was built around being an entrepreneur, and people would think I was failing if I decided to do something else. And right. And I realized just like how much ego was involved towards the latter end of that. And only when I became honest with myself around that, and then figuring out how to think about that differently and the realities of what that actually was versus how I was perceiving it, was I able to shift and transform the trajectory of my life.
Yeah. I always think that that's also, again, like the fact that the individual, like individuals make up the culture, and by doing that, you're challenging the culture, because there's this culture around success and a very limited view about what success looks like.
Mm-hmm. Which is, how ridiculous is that?
It's ridiculous, but it's heavy. Like, oh, it's so...
I was in it.
Exactly.
I was acting in it, and I was like, wait a minute. Which is, here's the funny part too, because in that 10 years, you know, I started the business, and then I started growing, and I was like, ooh, and now we scale, because that's what you do when you have a company. And I scaled, and then I was like, oh, I have employees, and I'm like doing stuff, and this is great, and I'm miserable. And mm-hmm. why am I miserable? And I realized, like, I'm miserable because I scaled. When it was just a couple of us, and I had freelancers working for me all the time instead of, like, being responsible for people's healthcare and whatever else, like, I was happier because I was actually doing the work versus running a business. And in that moment, I was like, oh my God, this is that fucked up success thing. Like, I didn't have to scale. I just thought I had to scale. And I didn't even consider that. And so I scaled back. And then I was happy for another like 3 years. And then I wasn't happy. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm doing it again. Like, I want to change. I don't want to do this anymore. But I'm in it because that's what success is. Success is running a you know, successful, quote, successful business for 10 years. And like, and it's so heavy. And then if you're not constantly vigilant with yourself about so much, then suddenly you're like, oh shit, there it was. There it it happened again. I can't believe it happened again.
Mm-hmm.
So frustrating and exciting, because life.
Well, it's that learning thing, right? And that, again, totally. Always being willing to learn. Like, oh, I can do things differently this time. That's always a choice. So to close, I always ask people to offer any advice or guidance that they would like to listeners who are engaged in this kind of work or looking to be engaged in this kind of work.
Go do something. I'm serious. Just go do something. Like, it can be the tiniest thing. It can be... oh, shameless pitch, participating in Badass History, right?
Yay.
Like, it can be embroidering. It can be going to vote. It can be being nice to somebody. You know, like, the more actions you take, the more actions you will take. Mm-hmm. And so sitting around and thinking, oh, I want to do this, but what would that look like? And, you know, or having a grand vision for what that thing should be, or I can't participate in that until I find this job where I'm, you know, getting paid 40 hours a week to do this thing. And it is the thing that will never get you there. That vision is the thing that will never get you there. You just have to like start marching and do anything and then do more and then do more. And all of those things are going to open up into a path that you never could have predicted.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great. I can't believe I told the altar girl story. This is great.
You heard it here first.
You really did. Like, nobody knows that story. So yay.
Shannon Downey is a craftivist and embroidery master. You can find her work and get involved in the Badass Herstory project by visiting badasscrossstitch.com. You can also follow her on Instagram, which I highly recommend. To learn more about my work in the world, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. Along with more episodes of Everything is Workable, you can find my blog, books, and art. You can also become a patron or leave a tip to help support the things that I do. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott, among others. Thank you to Tejai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.